Now, this film offers fascinating character portrait, in particular two women, Elle and Taylor. I thought that was like an interesting, the sort of collision between survival and artistic aspiration is sort of an important theme in your film. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, the film, the core conceit of the movie really is about these two young women who, as you say, they're living in Bondi, and they've been sold this dream by pop culture. You know, they can have it all and they deserve it all. The film leaps into the middle of their lives. And as you say, it opens up with a scene of one of them kind of ending a relationship at the, you know, an opening scene of the film. And gradually, as the film unwinds, these characters kind of start to semi-reflect on their lives, as it were. So they have to question whether or not they can live this dream, you know, the dream that pop culture has promised them. And that's really, I think, a core challenge for any millennial today living in any major urban center. We're always bombarded with photos on Instagram of how we should be living and how we should be looking. And it's magnified, of course, to people who are in the arts, because they're obviously being bombarded with, oh, you should be successful as a writer, you should be successful as a photographer, you should be successful as a filmmaker. And you see all these people, courtesy of pop culture, who are seemingly successful and have made it all. And you've got Kylie Jenner, who's a billionaire, actually, at 21. And so you see all this, you know, this extreme pressure, and they feel a sense of entitlement. But as, you know, the film explores, they can never achieve that dream. It doesn't matter how hard they work, they can just never achieve it.
This was shot in Bondi, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Bondi eateries and bars, and there's almost the atmospherics of the actual suburb throughout this. Was that an explicit decision to sort of focus on a particular sort of totemic locality in Sydney?
Absolutely, yeah. Myself, you know, I was living there. I recently moved out of Bondi a few weeks ago, actually, but I was there for 8 years of my life. All of the actors that worked in the film, you know, they're all professional actors. We'd all worked together on kind of bigger commercial projects, and my day job is being a film producer. When we undertook this project together, it was important that we, you know, again, looking at this conceit of talking about this dream that pop culture sells us all, and particularly millennials, there is no bigger pop culture dream than Bondi in Australia. Like, that's the kind of image, kind of good-looking person who earns money for doing nothing and living in Bondi, is that's quintessentially having made it. And so it was really important to us that we set the film there and to explore that. And every scene was shot in Bondi landmarks, in terms of restaurants and locations and bars. Everything is recognizable to people who have been to Bondi.
Yeah, so you have this really interesting contradiction. You have all this materialism, and at the same time, it sort of seems to run against the actual sort of bonhomie of the characters, the aim of these characters to live free lives, and that they seem to be more and more sort of getting caught in the sort of the treadmill of the dreary jobs.
I guess that's part of the challenge, and that's what they have to come to terms with. And I won't spoil the film for your listeners, but some of the characters in the film do kind of come to terms with the fact that they might actually have to work a 9-to-5 job at the end of the film. And some of them just refuse to accept that and want to keep on living that airy-fairy bohemian existence. But there's that kind of constant question, and how do you make money? How do you survive? How do you do that? And again, when you look at people who do live in Sydney, in the eastern suburbs or the inner west, I'm sure they'll relate to this conundrum that I always had when I was when I was rushing to and from jobs. There's all these people in their activewear all the time who look beautiful but don't actually seem to have any gainful employment. And that's the world that these characters inhabit, and that's the world that they think they deserve.
And the title now, Diamond, refers to a chocolate oyster, which is kind of like a empty kind of concoction. How did you come up with this term? I mean, I'm not trying to give away a certain sort of, that sort of appears sort of later in the film, but...
Its essence is the notion that chocolate is amazing and oysters are amazing if you're into that sort of thing. But when you combine them, it's super disgusting. And it's just too much of a good thing is not good, I suppose, is what we're getting at. And then obviously it plays a core part of the film as well, which, you know, people will see if they watch the movie.
And you made the decision to shoot the film in black and white. I mean, when I first saw it, I was thinking a lot of Woody Allen's Manhattan, the sort of influences that inspired this film.
It was a conscious decision from day one to film in black and white. And so we had these cameras that were kind of hacked so that they were black and white all the time. They could never shoot color, because I knew if we shot in color and then processed it in black and white later on, we might change our minds. So from day one, it was black and white. It could never change. And all the lenses were actually lenses that we hired that were from the 50s and 60s. And it was to give it a very specific aesthetic, the idea being that it would run parallel or counter to technology. So we really played down, like in the film, there's a couple of mobile phones, but you never see what they're looking at. You never see them on Facebook. You never see them on the internet, even though we know that kind of persuasively is all there.
And you have these conversations, which are actually just sort of punctuated by them all looking at their phones. So you always have that sort of competition of attention that
you do. Yeah, yeah. But you never see the text messages. That was a conscious decision to really highlight the kind of relationship that we have with technology at the moment. And, you know, in terms of references and inspiration, definitely John Cassavetes, also some Woody Allen earlier work. And in terms of the performances in the film and the way we shot it, because we did the whole film is made using a technique called retroscripting, where we wrote the whole film, but the actors didn't know the story, and all the dialogue and every scene is improvised, which is what gives it that documentary feel. So it all feels really realistic. It's often called mumblecore as well, because the actors often mumble because they're making up the dialogue as they kind of go along, and they don't know where they're going. We know where they're going. They don't know where they're going. And that is very much inspired by some Larry David, Kirby Enthusiasm, mm-hmm. or Ken Loach, you know, like a lot of Ken's films as well. Are retroscripted, and that's just a creative technique that I thought would be really interesting when exploring this sort of story, to make it feel like hyper realistic. Like the characters are often bumbling and, you know, using ums and likes all the time, because it is real dialogue. It's not scripted.
Even Mike Lee also has that sort of thing where he uses a lot of improvisation, but he actually doesn't tell the characters, like they actually don't know about their sort of what the character arc of their thing is. And they may not even know if they're the main character or they're a minor character within the thing. It's not until later in the... Was there a sort of similar process in this?
Exactly, we did. Yeah, we did exactly the same thing. And so what we did is we rehearsed all the backstories. So as an example, like I say, the film opens with this very long scene in one take with one of the principal characters. She's dumping her boyfriend at the beginning of the film, and then she begins her adventure. And so we rehearsed their relationship and them meeting. But they, like the poor actor who gets let go, you know, dumped, he had no idea that was coming. You know, he had different motivation in the scene, and they get in there, and then, you know, we give them the kind of motivation and kind of conflicting goals that they have to achieve, and then they go for it. And then often when the phones are pinging or whatever, we'd often look for devices to give them directions. So we might be texting them or doing other things to kind of give them direction. But the crew know what's happening because we've mapped it all out.
And the film also includes a cameo from playwright Stephen Sewell. Now, he's at a sort of caricature of a sort of dinner party, and quite interesting lines about the madness of the artistic pursuit, and that, you know, no one's going to choose the pursuit of arts as a sort of financial safe job.
Yeah, it's great work, Mr. Stephen. And I actually, in my other life as a film producer, I produced Embedded, which is his directorial debut. Of course, he's written a number of great films and movies and stuff, but his first film that he directed, I produced, and that's how I met him. And we've become friends, and I, you know, he really plays a very heightened form of himself in that dinner party. He's quite a cruel person in that scene. In real life, he's a lovely, lovable guy, but in the film, he comes across quite nasty and doling out some advice, young people, not to bother getting into the creative fields.
That sort of persona of the successful playwright, passing out those sort of nuggets of wisdom.
Yeah.
Interesting. Was there a sort of a commentary also about how the sort of affluence of inner city, that contrary sort of a wowserism, sort of like with associated with things like the lockout laws? I just thought that sort of the film's conclusion had that interesting sort of thing of, as much as there's this sort of revelry of, you know, free spiritness, there's also quite a sort of conformity at the same time.
You know, absolutely. And it's almost like it's one giant meme in that respect. I mean, I like to think that the film has a lot of kind of meta stuff going on in it. And we certainly worked really hard. There's a lot of things going on thematically throughout the film. But in sense of it being one giant meme, you start off with these characters who are free spirited and free loving and trying to live the dream. And then, you know, by the end of it, for one of them in particular, it's kind of a push towards conservatism. And once you get that wealth, like once you achieve the dream, if you can achieve it, or part of the dream, your number one goal is to stop other people from achieving the dream, because it risks your position at the top of the pyramid, so to speak.
So there's even like a bit of a sort of satire on sort of easy notions of friendship, of Facebook friendship, of, you know, not, you know, I mean, you know, it's easy to say we have all these friends, but are they really authentic, you know, authentic nature of friendship?
Yes, and I love that. And again, I don't want to spoil the film for your listeners, but, you know, there is one character who has all these amazing friends, and she's really beautiful and spends a lot of time, you know, with all these kind of quote-unquote friends. But then when push comes to shove and she really needs somebody to help her out, everybody magically evaporates. And it turns out that nobody actually really cares. They're all happy to be seen in the right place and go out with her. But when it, you know, actually comes down to something serious, it turns out that, yeah, there's nobody around to help.